putting a hypothetical price tag on Syria.
And companies and individuals prepare for the fiscal cliff. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. It's the Marketplace Midday Update for Thursday, the 9th of August. Lots of good stuff coming up today, including you might think that poorer families have a harder time paying for college. And of course, to a certain extent, that is true. But some new analysis from the Wall Street Journal gives us something new to think about. Families who make quite a bit of money, in fact, are the ones carrying more and more student debt.
Also coming up, we've heard about the drought and the impact that's having on food prices. Well, a global food and agriculture official is telling countries not to stockpile their agricultural goods to make sure that there's enough to go around. We'll talk to him coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start in Syria, where rebel forces are battling with the government for control of the economic hub of Aleppo. It's being called a must-win area for the Assad regime if that regime is to maintain control of the country. Now, at crucial moments like this in the Libyan conflict, there was assistance for the rebels from the U.S. and NATO in both money and materials. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looks now at how a similar intervention in Syria might price out.
The highest cost scenario might be called the Iraq option. Ken Pollack of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution says that's the U.S. going in more or less alone to crush Assad.
200,000 to 300,000 American troops, and would probably cost, at least in its first years, $200 to $300 billion.
The Libya option costs a fraction of that, but a U.S.-European air campaign might not work given Syria's military strength. And with the euro in crisis, there's little appetite for expensive military adventures. Plus, Pollack says, Syria lacks one thing Libya and Iraq both have: oil.
Syria may be a humanitarian tragedy, but it doesn't engage American vital interests, in large part because it is not connected to the oil.
The Gulf states do see Syria as vital, so they may ramp up funding of the rebellion. Pollack says they bankrolled the first Gulf War, saving U.S. taxpayers a lot of money. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Jeremy, this scandal over the British bank Standard Chartered we've been talking about this week quite a bit is taking some interesting turns. Just to recap, this week New York's top financial regulator charged the bank with concealing transactions for Iranian clients, and that breaks U.S. sanctions against Iran. And Standard Chartered could lose its New York license over this, which would be pretty devastating. But the affair is diverging from the storyline of other recent British banking investigations. And here with more on that is Christopher Wirth. He's covering the story for us from London. Hello, Christopher.
Hey, good morning.
In these other recent scandals, we had near-instant resignations at Barclays, complete contrition from HSBC. Not here. Sounds like Standard Chartered is coming out swinging.
Yeah, it would seem so, Jeff. You know, I want to play you two clips just to illustrate how bold an approach Standard Chartered is taking here. First one, here's HSBC's former compliance head, David Bagley, speaking in front of the Senate just last month after money laundering allegations against it.
HSBC has fallen short of our own expectations and the expectations of our regulators.
And here's Peter Sands, the CEO of Standard Chartered, speaking to the Financial Times yesterday about the money laundering allegations it's facing.
We were very surprised by the announcement, and we strongly reject both the position and the portrayal of the facts.
So two very different responses there, Jeff. It appears Standard Chartered is considering taking legal action against the New York regulator for reputational damage.
Violating sanctions against Iran is a federal crime, so are federal regulators now looking to go after Standard Chartered too?
Well, Reuters reports that the U.S. Treasury has written the British government to say it is investigating Standard Chartered and that it takes these violations extremely seriously.
And what's been the reaction in London to all of this, to U.S. regulators cracking down on all these British banks?
Yeah, well, I have to say the mood here is getting rather defensive. You know, there's a general suspicion around that, you know, there are all these overzealous American regulators trying to prove their mettle in the U.S. and are taking it out on British bankers. The mayor here in London, Boris Johnson, you may have seen photos of him recently dangling from a wire at an Olympic event. He is very protective of the banking sector in London, rightfully so. And he accuses U.S. regulators of being motivated by jealousy of London as a global financial center.
Christopher Wirth for us in London. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks.
Quick check of the market. Asian markets closed up today, just about 1% in most of the major indexes. And in Europe, mixed result, not a ton of action. U.S. markets just nudging up so far in this early point in the trading day. The U.S. trade deficit is the smallest in a year and a half, and we can thank lower oil prices for that, among other things. And as well, the number of Americans filing for unemployment fell unexpectedly last week.
The latest economic data out of China show a continued economic slowdown there. New numbers on factory output and retail sales came in below expectations this morning. The BBC's Juliana Liu joins us from Hong Kong with the latest on that. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is new exactly in today's numbers?
Well, I think investors and China watchers globally were looking to see if there were any signs of an economic rebound. And they didn't really get signs of that. Industrial production actually fell. They were supposed to have risen. Retail sales also fell from the previous period. So really, the only good news came from inflation. Prices were lower, which is good for the Chinese consumer. But otherwise, the good news that a lot of people were looking for didn't show up.
Now, before the Chinese government was hoping for growth, they were trying to slow down the economy. So do they think that they went too far down that road?
It looks like it may have already gone that way. You know, China is an enormous country with a lot of regional variation. But one economist based in Tsinghua University, Patrick Shivanik, says that in some areas he thinks that growth for the whole year might only be 4 to 5%, that in fact these official numbers don't actually reflect the extent of the slowdown. I think the picture's clearer if you look at corporate earnings. For example, Cathay Pacific, based here in Hong Kong, the world's biggest carrier of air cargo, they made a massive loss in the first 6 months of the year. So I think the worry right now is that definitely, as you say, the slowdown might have been overdone.
The BBC's Juliana Liu in Hong Kong. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Elsewhere in China today, the wife of disgraced politician Bo Zhilai went on trial for the murder of a British businessman. And then it was over. It was a 7-hour murder trial. We don't see a lot of those here in the U.S.
Yeah.
No verdict as of this moment. Bo, the politician in question, faces himself accusations of abuse of power. And the whole scandal's been embarrassing to Chinese leaders. But what do people think of Bo in Chongqing, the massive inland province where he was in charge? Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz went there to find out.
Egomaniac, corrupt, power-hungry. This is how many on China's east coast describe Bo Zhilai. But here in the courtyard of a public housing project in Chongqing, 55-year-old Yi Rong says outsiders have it all wrong.
Everyone here has benefited from Bo's policies. Other government officials just brag about how they help the people. Bo actually helped us in ways we can touch and feel.
One example, Yi's home. Yi lives in one of dozens of 30-story towers that make up Minxin Jiayuan, one of China's largest public housing projects and a centerpiece of Bo's social welfare agenda. Yi pays a subsidized rent that, if he chooses, will count toward the purchase of his unit someday. Rent for residents below the poverty line is as low as $10 a month. Yi says that's unheard of in the rest of China.
Thanks to Bo, elementary school students get free milk and eggs every day. And he tackled crime, too.
Others I spoke to here also gushed about Bo. Carolyn Cartier, professor of human geography and China studies at University of Technology, Sydney, says the only problem here is that Bo's policies weren't really his at all. The public housing project, for example, was a national campaign aimed at more than a dozen Chinese cities.
If you're sitting in the central government and looking out at Chongqing, you're realizing that Bo Zhilai has just taken off with your plans and turned them into his own fantasy world.
Back at the Chongqing housing project, 26-year-old Yang Yiqing can't say enough good things about the former leader.
I'm reminded of how great Bo was every day when I return home. He's given us so much.
I ask Yang what she thinks now that her favorite leader is under house arrest. Her eyes widen. He's under house arrest? What happened? Someone who seems so in love with Bo's vision of a better Chongqing, I can't bring myself to tell her. In Chongqing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The world could face the worst food crisis in 5 years if countries like the U.S. start restricting exports of agricultural products. That's according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, which says bad weather is causing a spike in global food prices that could be made worse if countries stockpile. Abdulreza Abbasian is senior economist with the UNFAO, and he's with us now from Rome. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, how much of this is bad weather, like the drought in the Midwest, and how much of it is a rise in global demand for food?
No, certainly not the demand. This price surge is characterized by the supply issue. The corn situation was already tight in the previous season, and U.S. is the biggest producer of corn, biggest user, and the biggest exporter. So obviously, having a drought as severe as we know we have in the U.S. will have an impact on that market. Soybeans doesn't fare any better. The soybean crops in South America were not very good, and there are hopes that the U.S. will make up for some of that deficit. But again, the drought is still continuing, and this has raised fear that even soybean may be short for still some time.
Now, you're asking countries, including the U.S., not to limit their exports of these things. Why is that?
U.S. traditionally had never put any restrictions on exports. Our real concern is with some of the other exporting countries. We hope that this time around, countries will not be putting those type of ad hoc restrictions without prior consultations, upon which we hope that any actions taken would be a coordinated one among the G20 members.
But I assume that's a tough sell for some countries which might want to take care of their own people first before they start exporting their food to the rest of the world.
Well, for as long as the G20 is concerned, and that basically means nearly over 90% of producers and consumers of the world, those countries have signed into agreeing that in the event of major problems in the world market, and I'm not saying we are there yet, and hopefully we won't, they are not going to take actions without yet consulting with one another so that there will be a coordinated policy response. So I guess it will be very difficult for them to take a unilateral action when only a few months ago they decided to establish such a system.
Abdulreza Abbasian, senior economist with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, some new figures from the Brewers Association, Jeff, show these are frothy times for the beer industry.
Yes, the beer industry.
The number of U.S. breweries is now 2,126, which is the most since the year 1887.
That's interesting. We talk so much about consolidation in the beverage and beer industry that I would have expected the opposite.
A lot of little craft breweries and stuff like that, but
sure.
Beer sales are actually up only 1% this year. And according to the Denver Post, that growth is due mostly to the fact that this is a leap year, which means there was one extra day for beer drinking.
That makes sense. Not terribly exciting, but it makes sense, doesn't it? Well, this fella is not going out for a beer, at least I hope not. He shouldn't be. The LG National Texting Competition has crowned America's fastest texter. Quite an honor. Repeat champion Austin Wierschke of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. He's 17 years old, and he's walking away with $50,000. So, Jeremy, he practiced for the event by sending 500 texts a day to his friends. I think those friends deserve a little cut of that money for putting up with that. And he says, very responsibly, he's saving for college. But do you text very much?
Oh, yeah, I text a lot.
Yeah, see, I don't text much because, good Lord, it's hard on the thumbs, I think.
Well, I imagine also Austin Wierschke must have a hard time with autocorrect, too.
Yeah, well, he's a talented young man, and I'm sure he's headed for college, but he might want to put just a little of that money away for his possible thumb surgery down the road.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
The big defense contractors, including Lockheed Martin and Pratt & Whitney, say they may have to send out mass layoff notices to their employees in a few months. Well, that's because they're worried that hundreds of billions of dollars in expected cuts to the Pentagon's budget will have a big effect on them.
But the Labor Department says such layoff notices are premature since the cuts are connected to the so-called fiscal cliff, which is far from a done deal. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
A law called the WARN Act is meant to protect American workers. It says factories and other big employers must tell workers if they know about an event that will jeopardize their jobs 60 days in advance. A few big defense contractors say they see an event like that on the horizon, federal budget cuts. If budget cuts kick in this January, aerospace and other manufacturers say they might have to lay off thousands of workers. But American University professor Gordon Adams says possible budget cuts wouldn't normally trigger a WARN Act notice.
Unless there is some specific expectation of a plant closure or a massive layoff, there's no reason for a contractor to be sending a WARN Act to any of its employees.
That's what the Department of Labor says, too. So why would defense companies notify employees of potential layoffs if they didn't have to? Politics, says Gordon Adams. A notice of potential job loss 60 days before January 2nd would be November 2nd, yes, right before the election. Defense contractors aim to use the threat of layoff notices, Adams says, to get promises of funding from the candidates. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, the fiscal cliff doesn't just involve potential cuts at the Pentagon. To find out what it could mean for the rest of us, we're joined by Patty Hirsch, who is the senior producer of Personal Finance at Marketplace. He's with us for our regular Money Matters segment. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jeremy.
So, you know, we've talked about the possible effects of the fiscal cliff on the economy. If Congress does not do anything about it, what kind of an effect is it going to have on individuals?
Well, it's going to have a big duplicate effect on individuals. Firstly, because you have all of the cuts that are going to spill through to government programs, so a lot of people are going to be laid off. But at the same time, you're also going to see an effect on your paycheck because of these immediate tax hikes that are going to kick in because of the removal of some of these tax breaks.
And you're talking about the Bush tax cuts, which have been in effect for a long time. So what exactly would happen with taxes for people?
Well, we've heard a lot about the effect on the rich, but what we should really focus on is the effect on the median American household. So, you know, the average family pays about 10% of income up to $17,000 right now, and 15% of all income between $17,000 and $69,000. But those rates are going to jump. For that first level up to $17,000, it would go up to 15%. For that next level up to $69,000, it's going to go up to 28%. So you're going to see an immediate effect on your paycheck.
And what about deductions, Patty?
Well, you know, not everybody pays the full tax rate, right? So every family gets deductions that whittle away at the tax burden.
Right.
But a lot of those deductions are going to disappear on January 1st. The child tax credit, you know, which used to give a family a $1,000 tax deduction each year, will be cut in half. The payroll tax holiday, which was this 2% Social Security tax cut on the first $110,000 in wages, that's going to disappear too. What about low-income families, which people are very concerned about as well? The loss of the earned income tax credit, that would disappear. That would be a problem for them. The tax credits that go for people who have children would also disappear.
And as we said, this is a big what if. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with all of this stuff. So what are people supposed to do while they wait and see what Congress does?
Well, the thing to do is to get smart. I mean, a lot of people are really intimidated by the whole idea of a fiscal cliff, and people aren't really getting as smart as they need to. You need to read up on this stuff. You can listen to Marketplace Money this weekend. We've got a story about it. Talk to your tax preparer. Make sure that they're getting smart about this stuff, too. If you don't have a tax preparer, consider getting one, because this next tax year could be very complicated.
Patty Hirsch, who is the senior producer of Personal Finance at Marketplace. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So the fiscal cliff is looming large in the immediate future, but there are also a lot of long-term concerns in this country, as I'm sure you all know. As many young adults struggle with finding a job and paying off student loans, and as families across the country work to pay off their mortgages, another group of people is even more worried about the future, those close to retirement. AARP recently conducted a survey looking to find out just how worried Americans over 50 are about the next few decades of their lives.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Nancy Lamond, an executive VP at AARP. She's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us a little bit about this anxiety index. How worried are seniors?
Well, they're very worried. The key finding of our poll that we've just released is that voters 50 plus, especially boomers who are still working, are driven by economic anxieties that go well beyond jobs. You know, in the current political environment, there's been so much talk about jobs, and there's no doubt that that's important to boomers. But it turns out they're even more worried about a number of things, including prices rising faster than their incomes, having to pay too much in taxes, having enough financial security in retirement, and especially their health expenses.
Aren't these things that folks in this age group have always been worried about?
Well, they have been worried about it, but what we've seen is they're even more worried now as a result of the economic recession over the last few years. And as they've had to look at a lot of their savings go down with the stock market and some of the economic challenges recently.
Do they have any options to help themselves deal with that, to help prepare for contingencies?
Well, sure. One of the other findings of the poll is that 72% believe that one of the ways they're going to deal with this is to delay retirement. 65 are very, very worried in this survey about having enough money to last through their retirement. And another way of dealing with it for 50% that we surveyed is they think they're going to stay in the workforce forever, that they really are not sure they're ever going to be able to retire.
We mentioned the fiscal cliff in our introduction to this conversation. AARP is, of course, very busy in Washington, and I'm sure your members are extremely concerned about that. Characterize your biggest fear for me.
Well, you know, as part of the discussion in Washington over the last year or so, we've tried to bring the voice of what real people are thinking and feeling, and that's part of what we believe this poll does. In addition, in March, we launched a national conversation called You've Earned a Say to talk with people over the age of 50, and in fact, people of all ages, about Medicare and Social Security to put the human face on these important programs. We think that the conversations we're having now across the country about the importance of these programs, how people see them, and also the options that have been discussed by policymakers of how they might be strengthened for the long term, we think this discussion is huge. Important.
But Nancy, isn't it a little irrational for them to have these fears? I mean, you know, both candidates have said that they're not going to touch Medicare or Social Security for people who are at a certain age, who are close to it or anything like that. It's somebody like me who should be worried about it, not them.
Well, I think everybody is understandably worried. I think there is so much cynicism about Washington. In the poll, we asked them about their confidence in the Congress, and it was in single digits. So I think it's understandable that a message from Washington politicians may not give them the most security in the world for those who are retired. And then for others, there still are questions about how and what proposals will be enacted to strengthen the programs. And I think, you know, fully 50% of people today over the age of 65 are living on incomes of $20,000 a year or less. So you can imagine how anxious they are even with Social Security and Medicare.
Nancy Lamond is an executive vice president with AARP. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, the NFL preseason is underway. Jeremy, do you pay it much mind?
No, not really. I've been watching the Olympics mostly these days.
Yeah, I didn't even know until we got this piece that the NFL preseason had opened. The Olympics are pretty distracting. And for the teams, in fact, you know, it's arguable how much they care. They're trying things out. People are trying not to get injured, right? It's kind of warm-up time. And the games, of course, don't count toward the regular season outcome. But when the Chargers and the Packers take the field tonight for preseason game in San Diego, they're going to be a part of football history. Well, this will be the first time NFL teams have been refereed by a woman. From KPBS in San Diego, here's Kyla Calvert.
I'm not a big football fan, but I will be keeping an eye on the Chargers-Packers game tonight, watching for Shannon Easton. Easton normally referees college football. She's making her historic NFL debut as a temporary replacement. That's because the league locked out its regular refs as part of an ongoing dispute over salary and retirement benefits. Kevin Quinn is a sports economist. He says the league thinks it can fill in with temporary replacements while it holds out for a better deal.
I think maybe the NFL would be willing to take a chance that the average fan wouldn't even notice this. And really, from a public relations point of view, I think a lot of the discussion about who's right and who's wrong here will be drowned out by talk of the first female referee.
Quinn says those hoping to see permanent female referees probably won't have to wait long.
I think that's inevitable. Absolutely inevitable. Part of the reason why is because the NFL is consciously marketing toward women.
So that growing female fan base will keep buying all those pink football jerseys. In San Diego, I'm Kyla Calvert for Marketplace.
Well, you might naturally think that poorer families have a harder time paying for college. Makes sense. And in many ways, that's of course true. But a new analysis of financial aid data from the Wall Street Journal found something surprising. In recent years, the American families that saw the biggest increase in their student debt burden were those making $95,000 to $205,000 a year. For more on the findings, I've got Ruth Simon. She co-wrote the story for the Journal along with Rob Berry. Ruth, thanks for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
So middle-upper-income families have seen a big jump in the percentage toting around student loan debt for their kids, for the most part. What's behind that trend?
There are a couple things behind that trend. One thing is college costs keep getting higher and higher, but the ability of families to pay that price tag out of their pocket, it's getting harder and harder. People are just nervous. There's still this anxiety about, you know, if I have this money, can I really use it all?
Seems like these kinds of families would, of course, be going to more expensive schools than other types of families. They also, I presume, can't get as much aid in terms of grants, right?
Well, there are a couple things that I'd say about that. One is there are a number of families that are choosing these more expensive schools, but even the public universities that I've talked to have reported that they're seeing more borrowing among upper-middle-income families. What we find is that lower-income families are likely to have a bigger portion of their tuition costs covered by grants and other kinds of aid of that like, and they're also, on average, sending their kids to less expensive schools.
Given the patterns that you're seeing here, what could be the possible effect on colleges themselves?
Well, colleges are reporting some price resistance, and that may mean that the most competitive colleges may still be able to get by pushing through these tuition increases, but most of the other schools are going to have a tougher time pushing through the kinds of big tuition increases that we've seen in the past.
Ruth Simon with Wall Street Journal. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Now to Blaine, Washington, where a state trooper rescued an injured seagull he found in the middle of I-5, Jeff. But when he put the bird into his cruiser to take it to a wildlife center to help it out, I think it had an injured wing, he got a call from a fellow officer who had stopped somebody for a ticket or something like that, and the guy just started driving off.
You got to do what you got to do. Yeah.
Exactly. So he's like, all right, well, I got this bird in the back, but we got to go and help this other guy. So the seagull gets to experience a ride-along, unexpectedly. The officer did not tell the local TV station Como if the seagull left any thank you gifts in the back seat for him.
There's a very limited amount of time I think you'd probably keep a seagull in your car
exactly.
without experiencing some sort of consequences. Well, this final item has nothing to do with that or anything else for that matter, but I thought it was fun. You know the Armageddon movie? Did you see that a few years ago?
Sure.
Bruce Willis and this team of miners, I think they were, as I recall, get blasted up in a space shuttle to an asteroid that's going to crash into Earth. And they perform a miracle. I think Bruce Willis, spoiler alert, has to sacrifice himself in the end on the asteroid. But they blow the thing in half. It splits and neatly bypasses the Earth on both sides. So we hear from time to time about the possibility of asteroids crashing into the Earth. That's what took care of the dinosaurs, they tell us now. And so a group of physics students, getting around to the main point in England, decided to test this out. Actually see whether it would be possible to pull off the Armageddon scenario. And what do you think the answer is? You got a guess?
It didn't work.
Very good. What a surprise. Hollywood was wrong on this one, or a little bit too optimistic. It would take, apparently, a bomb a billion times as powerful as any bomb ever created on the planet Earth in order to split the asteroid in the first place. And more than that, you would need to be able to pinpoint the exact spot where you split it from about 8 billion miles away. So put that all together, it adds up to...
Guess we're going to have to come up with another plan.
Right. Hollywood ain't real. That's the headline of today. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.